books, get out of your seat. Down the hall and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old. Drums loud and bold. Rock, rock, rock and roll. Feeling is there, body and soul.
WBAI, WBAI.
The New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
The census is a count of everyone in the United States, no matter your immigration status. The census count is how our communities get billions of dollars for programs that we all rely on. You'll be able to do this online or even over the phone. Now let's go through some of the questions.
This looks easy. So the census asks, how many people live in your home? Do you rent or own? Everyone's name, how you're related, age, ethnicity, and home phone number. So me and my wife, we have two kids. I'm 40.
You get the idea. Your information is completely confidential. By law, it cannot be shared with anyone. The census only comes once every 10 years, and 2020 is our chance to get it right.
You are tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org. On the web, coming up next, Living for the City with your host, Michael G. Haskins. Living for the City. That's right. Living for the City. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and good day to you. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stevie Wonder's classic tune, Living for the City. Living for the City is a program focusing on telling the stories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. And if you've lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue in some circumstances. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the power of the real estate lobby, truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interests or loyalties. And we do that, I say the we, myself, Michael G. Haskins, and Jillian Jonas, a senior producer who has been working with me. We've been working together since 2014, so I really appreciate Jillian's input and her support over all these years, over all of these years. Now, we'll be hearing from Jillian later on in the program. Jillian will take us into City Hall. She's been at the press conferences of Mayor Bill de Blasio for several weeks now, and so she'll take us inside for some questioning of various city officials. So we'll do that. We have Sankofa Moments in Time. I'm going to make time for that. I'm going to make time for Labor History in Two with Rick Smith. Some of the things that I used to do regularly, and I'm going to bring it back and incorporate that into Living for the City. And I do appreciate all of the support that I've been getting from individuals far and wide, out of the state, in this tri-state area as well. So thank you so much for that. We are a listener-sponsored and commercial-free radio station on the air for 60 years. And, you know, it's not just a fallback for me. This is part and parcel of what all of us should be doing as broadcasters on this radio station, because it's commercial-free. Commercially free, we have to let our listeners know, new listeners and some listeners who've been around for a while, that we need their support if they can see to it to give us that support. All right, so let's begin, shall we? Perhaps one of the most controversial city-proposed rezonings is the one planned for the Sunnyside Yards area in Queens. You know about that? Think Hudson Yards on steroids. Of course, at massive taxpayer expense, and spearheaded by the New York City Economic Development Corporation, or EDC, which seems to work primarily for developers and the wealthy, on a proposal many residents who currently live in the neighborhood are very aware is not meant for them. Sounds like a familiar MO, doesn't it? Well, with me today is Emily Sharp, the founder of Stop Sunnyside Yards, and Donnelly Rodriguez, an activist and organizer with Queens Democratic Socialists of America and the Justice for All Coalition. Donnelly and Emily, thank you for being on Living for the City, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's start with you, Emily, because we've only covered this project superficially. We want to go into depth with this, because some of this people don't know about it, particularly when I said Hudson Yards on steroids, people don't know. What are some of the basic facts, Emily? What has been proposed, particularly for our listeners and producers, actually, who may not know?
Okay. Thank you so much for having me on today, Michael. Yes, and many people don't know about Sunnyside Yards, although it is about seven times larger than Hudson Yards, like you said, on steroids. It covers a space of about 180 acres in western Queens, right by Long Island City. It is owned by Amtrak, and mostly by Amtrak and MCA, and one private business there. And the city wants to, well, Amtrak... Well, we don't really know exactly what's coming, but EDC has said will be coming is more affordable housing and jobs and all the stuff that they always promise. Mm-hmm. We like to call it the Trojan horse, because they never are able to deliver right on their promises. And you can just look at some of their, you know, things that they've tried to do to bring jobs. The New York Works program from 2017, you know, they promised 100,000 good paying jobs, and they're in 10 years, and they're only up to 3,000, and they reforecast to 35,000. And then we know the housing is not coming. It's we have more homeless people here now than the Great Depression. So that is not working either. So what we see in the community, well, firstly, nobody asked for this other than, you know, some of the powerful people, Melinda Katz and some people that she appointed to the community board. But nobody was clamoring for this project in Sunnyside or in Astoria or Long Island City. And actually, if you go out and speak to the community, a lot of people don't even know about it. And they don't know how bad it will be. they might have heard something. But if they sit down and like really look at the project, they would not want it to come. It's basically a land grab. You know, it's about legacy. It's about egos. It's about, you know, swapping out our blue collar jobs for white collar jobs. So our tax base grows rather than putting in the hard work and the money into education and, you know, educating our people and letting them take the good jobs, the good paying jobs. You know, it's about, let's get rid of the people here. Yeah. Let's display, you know, yeah. It's going to be displacement of small jobs or small businesses.
Yeah, either way you look at it, it's going to be displacement. Now, Emily, you have serious objections to the process. Can you elaborate, before I go to Danelli, can you elaborate? I mean, you're certainly not alone in this feeling.
No, definitely not. The process through the EEC, basically they have their public meetings and they, you know, they check all the boxes they need to. The community shows up and there's a lot of people say no, like, what if we don't want this? And it's not a democratic process because, like I said, we didn't ask for it. Mm-hmm. And there's no way of saying, no, we don't want this. They just kind of march on and say, we heard you. Mm-hmm. And they note that they were at their meetings and all that. But so they've had their public meetings where people do say no, mm-hmm. Or it's not what we need. And then when they came out with their master plan, it was, you know, they did it at a community board meeting where, you can't speak as a community member, until the very end. It's just a couple of minutes of comment, but it's really not for us. And, the plan, it's just a big data dump, really, the master plan. It's unverifiable information and just unknowable, you know, mm-hmm. stuff about, you know, they get really specific on the details of fire, you know, if there's going to be a fire, there's like formulas for that, but then they can't get specific on the affordability. So it's like, okay, so, you know, it's just like to keep us occupied, look over here, here's this big data dump, you guys just look at these documents while we take over your land, basically.
Right. So that's Emily Sharp, the founder of Stop Sunnyside Yards. Danelli Rodriguez, an activist and organizer with Queens Democratic Socialists of America and the Justice for All Coalition. Danelli, the EDC is making the requisite promises about jobs. Emily just said that, affordable housing, ditto. We know the drill. Tell us what you think will really happen here.
Hey, thanks again, Michael, for having us on the show. Absolutely. And covering this super important topic. Yeah. But I think what's going to happen is what we've seen historically throughout New York City when the Economic Development Corporation sets out plans of these nature. I mean, look at Brooklyn Navy Yards, right? Look at Barclays Center and these other mega projects that have come to our city. It has led to the vast displacement of Black, Brown, and poor communities here in New York City. Because at the end of the day, the bottom line about this project is about profit. It's not about securing housing, affordable housing, and deeply affordable housing for the communities that have been here for years, that have been working for years, that have deeply invested rooting their families into these communities. It's really about, you know, the real estate lobby and trying to make New York City a city for the wealthy and for the rich. And you can look at Hudson Yards, which is a prime example of this project, right? A project that basically gerrymandered Harlem so that they can access $1.2 billion in public funding for poor communities in order to fund Hudson Yards, which is now a space that is not even accessible to working class and poor people, and neither is it affordable for working class and poor people, right? So this is just a carbon copy of the Hudson Yards project. they're stating that there will be affordable housing anywhere from 2,400 to 7,000 units. But the reality is, like, the affordable housing policy that exists in New York City right now is classes. It doesn't necessarily take into account the directly surrounding income of a community. It's taking the entire city's average median income, which brings it to roughly 70,000. And that's not the reality of everyday New Yorkers, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have to win a lottery in order to get into these affordable housing units. So it's like, what is this? This is an absolute joke. It's not for housing. It's for the real estate lobby, you know, and it's, you know, this is just a year out after we kicked out Amazon HQ2 from coming into our city, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a very coordinated plan to gentrify my neighborhood and the neighborhoods of many Black, brown, and poor communities throughout New York City. So I think, ultimately speaking, if this plan were to move forward, it would change the very fabric and moral fiber of the community that I grew up in here in Astoria, Queens, and in Long Island City, mm-hmm. and the ones of the other surrounding communities. We saw when Amazon announced that they were coming in, rent skyrocketed in Long Island City and in Astoria. Mm-hmm. And this is what we can expect to see as well if something of the scale of Sunnyside Yards were to come to our city.
Let me just reintroduce the program. This is Living for the City on radio station WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. We're available online at WBAI.org, where you can find out about the station. Just the station in general, what programs are on at what time, how you can find Living for the City or Democracy Now! Or the Gary Null Show or Con Sabor Latino. Whatever program you're interested in, go to WBAI.org. We also have a dedicated website for all kinds of thank you gifts. And thank you gifts range from the CDs. Nobody has CDs anymore. You'd be surprised. CDs, DVDs, all kinds of books and things that we talk about regularly on these airwaves, and something like we're discussing right now. Now, Donnelly, I want to stay with you. I understand the build-out, which is supposed to start with Sunnyside Station, will take decades. And, pardon me. And work won't begin before next year's mayoral election. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what they're claiming, right? And I honestly don't know what to believe, because the whole process has been just in the shadows, right? They just threw out this plan on our plates without any community input, and then asked us how high we wanted the buildings to be, or where we wanted them to be specifically, and these type of things. Very superficial comments. But ultimately speaking, can you ask the question again? Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's but there's talk about the build out, which is supposed to start with Sunnyside Station, yeah. and that it's going to take decades for that to happen. But work won't begin on that before next year's mayoral election. Is all of that true? And since you're there, and since you mentioned height, that they mentioned height, what are height restrictions, or what's being talked about in that regard?
Yeah. So, I feel like that's very much a way to try to placate community resistance to the project, saying that it's so far out, right? Mm-hmm. And how is it really going to impact our community members now if it's going to be built so far down the line, right? Is it really for the community that exists here right now? And we've seen, you know, exponential rates of displacement through gentrification because of the cost of living increase over the years. So, like, how can we even anticipate the community members that are living here now to even have access to that down the line? So I think, honestly, it's a strategy to placate, you know, community resistance in the project so that they can, you know, kind of continue to shove this down our throats behind the scenes, right? Sort of how they did originally with this project where we didn't know about it and then we knew about it, right? But yeah, in terms of like the sizes of the building and all of these things, it's like it's really just cosmetic things that they're inquiring about within the community. It's not taken into consideration whether the community here even wanted this project to begin with. As Emily had mentioned, you know, the community has, you know, stated time and time again that we do not want this project, right? They had this sort of like fake democratic process of you know, inquiring in the community on how we want this space to look. And throughout every meeting, they were met with community resistance up to the point where the final meeting was at the CUNY School of Law, where I currently attend. Mm-hmm. And students, alongside community members, just shut down the entire process because we got to the point where it was like, we're fed up with this. We've told you guys time and time again that this project is not something that's going to benefit our community. Mm-hmm. So we decided to just, you know, air our grievances through some good old civil disobedience. But yes, this is just simply, I think, a way to try to placate us about, you know, resisting against this project. And a lot of the process has been cosmetic, right. Input.
And what about the height of the platform over the train yards? I was doing some reading and I saw something about that, but I'm not really sure, you know, the relevancy of that. Can either one of you speak about that or speak to that, the height of the platform over the train yards? Do you know?
Yeah, I can speak to that. So the perimeter is going to be at least, well, it's going to be about 2 to 3 stories high on the perimeter. And so that's, you can just imagine walking along now and seeing a, you know, 70-story building on top of a 3-story platform. Like the grades are so steep, actually, that there's places where cars can't get up. And the way to get onto the platform are going to be through switchback stairways and elevators and things. So it's going to be starting out, it's going to be on a 3-story platform, and there's areas throughout the yard that have to be higher. So, and they're kind of in the original feasibility study, there's a place, it talks about 109 feet tall. So that's about 10 stories tall. But throughout this process, the EDC has said, no, we were able to shave off some, you know, some feet on that. And we worked with the railroads and they say we can have less clearance. But the fact is, if you walk across the Sunnyside, any of the bridges across Sunnyside Yards, you'll see the overhead wires and how high they have to be for the trains to get clearance. Mm-hmm. You can only go so much. There's only so much play in there that you can bring it down. So, you know, and so it's going to be, you know, let's say you take off a little bit, you know, 8 stories, 5 stories. There's places, different heights, but 5 stories, 6 stories tall. So this is huge. Wow. You know, luxury land on top of a platform.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what you just said, Emily. I'm really struggling. You 70 stories, 3-storied platforms. I mean, that's a lot.
It is.
That's really a lot. So let's talk about for a moment the formation of a nonprofit board here. Akin to the Battery Park City Authority, and we know how well that worked out. Can Donnelly or Emily, can you talk to your knowledge of this this nonprofit board that's being proposed?
Okay. I can speak to it unless you want to, Donnelly?
Yeah, you can speak to it, and I'll add some things at the end.
Okay. So the EDC has come out with a plan because this whole project is going to be, it keeps shifting the amount of money, but it's going to be, you know, they say $22 billion and then $14 billion, and we don't really know, but we know it's for sure it's going to be probably, you know, $100 billion probably in the future. It's going to be 50 to 100 year build out. So by the time it's all done with cost overruns, but so they want to, talking about basically taking this whole process, it sounds like, out of the public realm and away from the messy community that might oppose it. Yeah. And form a nonprofit, and they did mention similar to Battery Park City Authority, and which that is a public benefits corporation, which is basically a corporation. And what happened at Battery Park City, originally it was planned to be a community of low income, middle income, and luxury housing, kind of like what we they're talking about Sunnyside Yards. And then, of course, it got shifted just all luxury. And they said, but we will still, you know, we'll dedicate some money to affordability in another area. So what they did was, like, they don't want the people there at Battery Park City, but they said they would dedicate money. So they had $1 billion stream of money, or dedicated stream. They said they were going to spend $1 billion on affordability, shoring up affordability. So they did spend about $163 million, I believe the number is, in upper New Manhattan and Harlem, or in the Bronx. And that's all they used of the $1 billion. And so what has happened is that money is being used to for Javits Center, mm-hmm. Jacob Javits Center, mm-hmm. to restore that, expand that. It's used for the general fund for the city. The state dips into it. Money is being used in ways that are not intended. So yeah, it's just a big scam. So basically, if they want to do that with Sunnyside Yards, you can see the same thing happening. And actually, Bill de Blasio was pressed on this to use some of that money for affordable housing, and he is not doing it. So that shows you where, you know, all his talk about affordability and bringing equity to the city, he's not really on board with that either. So, yeah, so I don't see this as a good thing.
Yeah, not really surprised there. Donnelly, I'm going to come to you in a minute. Not really surprised there about the mayor and his stance on this. But we'll be going into a press conference that the mayor has, his daily press conference. Jillian Jonas, the senior producer for this program, was in that virtual. Everything is virtual nowadays. And so she got to ask a couple of questions for Living for the City, for WBAI, and I'm very, very proud of that and her effort, her tenacity at getting in there and putting WBAI's name out there. Delaney, did you want to respond on that as well? Because I want to ask you to explain about the Superfund issues as well. So take either issue you'd like.
Yeah. No, with respect to the last question and, you know, the board, and I think the board is just as cosmetic as, like, their inquiry in the community about what the Sunnyside Yard should look like, because the board isn't democratic in nature. The question is, who are making these decisions? Who's appointing these individuals on the board? If you look at that Economic Development Corporation, which is a public-private partnership, there's really no accountability from the public to the Economic Development Corporation. It's just the mayor's agents.
Good.
And their real estate lobby goons, basically, right? So, you know, they can talk about a board and these things, but if they're the ones appointing and deciding who these people are, and they're not actually taking democratic input from the people who live here, and if they're just asking us about superficial and cosmetic things with respect to the projects, but not answering very basic and fundamental questions about the cost of whether this is actually feasible and doing studies on how this will impact the community, then it's not democratic. Then it's not publicly accountable, right? At the end of the day, it's really leveraging, you know, private markets and private management and private interests and being masqueraded for public purposes, right? Mm-hmm. And we all know how that's played out over the years.
Now, explain the Superfund issues, if you would.
I'll defer to Emily there with respect to the Superfund.
Emily, if you don't mind, talk about the Superfund issues. Emily Sharp, the founder of Stop Sunnyside Yards. We just heard from Donnelly Rodriguez, an activist and organizer with the Queens Democratic Socialist of America and the Justice for All Coalition. I'll come right to you, Emily. I just want to continue on what I was saying before about WBAI, the importance of WBAI, the fact that it is listener-sponsored, and the fact that we can spend this time, we only have a little bit of time left, but the fact that we can talk about these issues. Sunnyside Yards, had you heard about that before? I'm sure maybe if that's Sunnyside is your neighborhood, you may have you may be familiar with that, but some may not be familiar with it. And that is why this program, I think some of the things that we do are important. And this radio station is important because it's listener sponsored and commercially free. At any time of the day or night, you can make a contribution in support of commercial free broadcasting. The only thing like this in New York City. Only thing like this in New York City, and that number is 516-620-3602. Make a contribution and say, I want to support living for the city. Emily, the Superfund issues, and then I want to talk about Dan Doktoroff. But let's talk about that.
Okay, so the Superfund site, Sunnyside Yards, has been... It's one of the most active railways in the country. It's been that way for about 100 years. And so over the years, lots of contamination. So I believe it was in late 80s or early 90s, Sunnyside Yards became classified by the state as a Superfund site, which means it's there's highly – I forget the exact – definition, but it's basically toxic and it's significant harm to individuals. So they set about cleaning it up, and it's a continuous process. But it's zoned to be an industrial only site. So that should mean, what residents would want to live on that.
Right.
And, it should only be what it is. And it's actually, they're expanding operations. Amtrak is adding tracks. They're going to have high-speed rail through there. There's about 1,000, it's going to be about 1,300 people in about 10 years that work there. Trains, 1,000 trains, trips go through there a day, very active. And then they want to put a platform over this whole, about 80% of it, and... cleanup has been ongoing, but it's going to be very difficult. And they say in this feasibility study, it's going to be difficult to continue cleaning that up with a platform over the top of it. And if you have trains in there all the time, it's never going to be clean. As much cleanup as you do, it will always be, emitting the toxic sludge or whatever it is. So there's that issue that people... I was shocked, actually, because I live really close to the Sunnyside Yard, the rail yards, and it's like, wow, how come nobody's talking about this right now? We live here now, and it's we should be testing it. But anyway, so that's a big issue that they're kind of just breezing over and not really thinking about too much. But I think we should really press them on that issue as well.
Mm-hmm. And, one of the city's most notorious pro-development alumnus is involved, I think. I'm speaking of Dan Doktoroff, former deputy mayor under Michael Bloomberg, who led such gems as bringing the Olympics to New York City, building a stadium on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the luxury development of Brooklyn Bridge. Is that of... the obvious question is that of concern to you? And talk about the Google Sidewalk Labs role. What is that? Is that a concern to you about Doktoroff?
Yes, it is a concern to me. I have been watching, or I had watched until it's no longer an issue, but there's in Toronto, a project called Quayside that Dan Doktoroff was involved in through Sidewalk Labs, which is owned by Alphabet, so Google, and Alphabet and all that. So Dan Doktoroff, who, as you mentioned, he's responsible. He's the longest running deputy mayor for Michael Bloomberg, responsible for Hudson Yards. He tried to bring the Olympics to New York and use it as a pretext to get zoning happening faster. The Long Island City waterfront. They talked about, Sunnyside Yards as a site for housing or, for Olympic housing, things like that. So, mm-hmm. I didn't really know about him too much until I started doing research about Sunnyside Yards and all this stuff. But he really has a lot of influence in the city. And you know, he's unelectable, unaccountable, but he's going to be putting money into the mayoral election in 2021. And it's a scary prospect because he was in charge of Sidewalk Labs. Like I said, he's the founder, CEO of this project up in Toronto, Quayside. It was going to be a smart city. Everything, networked with digital sensors everywhere so they could, you know, see what's happening. Basically, a big data harvesting, you know, like that's how AI is created with, you know, getting as much information as you can from people. So surveillance capitalism on steroids. Mm-hmm. So I'm afraid, you know, that got scuttled. Luckily for the people of Toronto, they really put it under the spotlight and made sure it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I could really see this. It's a big space. I could see him wanting to do that here. And, you know, with coronavirus, politicians and business leaders always try to find a reason to throw a bunch of money into some project.
Right.
So I feel like that would probably be it.
Is for sure. We've seen that over and over again. Donnelly Rodriguez, we're going to have to leave it right there. Is there any, finally, before I ask you both for some contact information, is there any need for preservation or landmarking in the area? Are people working on that? And we only have about a minute for that. Donnelly?
Not to my specific knowledge, but I feel like, you know, that is a possible avenue to just, you know, making sure that historic areas of the community aren't being utilized to prioritize private interests for the real estate lobby and the displacement of, you know, communities that have been living here for years. That's a potential tactic for that, right? Because once you have that status, you can't really make changes without really lobbying the community in a meaningful way. So I think that that's definitely, you know, a political tool that we can utilize to prevent something like this from happening. And just to the prior point about David, this is just another play out of the playbook of the real estate lobby throughout the years in the city, is really prioritizing that model where we're going to, you know, give real estate and developers free reign, tax free, to build in our city under the guise of jobs, right? And building affordable housing. But we know time and time again what this evolves into.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for your time. We spent quite a bit of time talking about this. And I think it's appropriate to do that because, as I've been saying over and over again, so many things are happening around us on just about every block where we live, and we need to know. How do people get in touch with your organizations, your respective organizations, and become involved in their own community as well? Donnelly Rodriguez, start with you, and then Emily, how do people get in touch?
Yeah, so you can follow us on social media with Instagram. You can follow the Queens Democratic Socialists at queens.dsa. And you can also follow us on Instagram as well with the Justice for All Coalition at Justice4AllQNS.
Excellent.
So again, that's at Justice J for All Queens. On Instagram. Thank you so much.
Okay. Emily Sharp, and you?
Yeah. So if you want to get involved, you can contact us at stopsunnysideyards@gmail.com. You can go to our website at www.stopsunnysideyards.org. And it's yards with an S, by the way.
Okay.
And Twitter, Sunnyside Yards, at Twitter, Sunnyside Yards. And then we're also on Facebook and Instagram.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Emily Sharp. Thank you very much, Donnelly Rodriguez, for your time today on Living for the City over WBAI. Thank you both very, very much. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free, community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. That's WBAI.org on the web. This is Billy Bang. I met Billy Bang at the studios of WBAI when we were located at 120 Wall Street. The host of the program, Perspective, How Wide the Parameters We Ourselves Establish Through Which to See and Measure More Clearly. That was how Lewis opened his show. And my regret, and Lewis has passed, but my regret is not being able to sit down and talk to this sage. I only know it now after the fact, after he's gone, and I really want to, you know, kind of kick myself for that. But I was, a live program preceded Lewis, and then he came on, and then there was, of course, Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. I terribly missed that program, so I never could get a chance to talk with Lewis Reyes Rivera and bring some of his material back from time to time. And what's so interesting about this particular piece, Vietnam Veteran, what is this? It's called Lonnie's Lament, Vietnam Veteran. Now, he has one here called Tunnel Rat, and someone who was a combat veteran. And through this music, through his music, he purged the demons of war. Incredible, incredible stuff came through WBAI and the producers on WBAI. This is Living for the City on WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm your host and producer, and the senior producer here at Living for the City is Jillian Jonas, and she has been, for several weeks, been attending the mayoral press conferences. So let's take a peek into the exchange between Jillian as she begins her conversation with the mayor.
Next up, we have Jillian from WBAI.
Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Hey, Jillian, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So many questions, so little time. I wanted to follow up on something that I asked about a few weeks ago. The state announced it would be expanding a pilot program to test wastewater for COVID as a, quote, early warning system. As I noted last time I asked, experts say the current indicators are lagging, and the city is especially well-positioned to use this technology because of our infrastructure of the 14 treatment centers and where they're located. And I understand we've already been testing for other bacterial and viral outbreaks for some time. I'd like to hear from Dr. Choksi, because I felt like Dr. Barney was rather dismissive of my question. So to what extent is the city undertaking this real-time level of testing, and when will the public have access to the data?
So I just got to jump in before Dr. Choksi. I have a really good memory, Jillian. I do not believe in the least Dr. Varma was dismissive of your question. I thought he actually answered your question. I remember when you asked it. Dr. Choksi, why don't you start, and then Dr. Varma, just like in a debate, if someone's name is invoked, they get their opportunity for a rebuttal. We'll get Dr. Varma in as well. Go ahead.
Sure, and thank you for the good question. I think it highlights what is the theme from this morning, which is we have to look at multiple sources of data for as many early warning signals as possible. That's why we've changed some of our thresholds. We've added degrees of precision to all of the indicators, you know, that we're already following. But to your point about wastewater epidemiology specifically, it is something that the health department is actively looking at. We have a group of environmental health experts who who do sampling of water, of air, of many other parts of our environment to figure out the different signals that we have, not just for COVID-19, but for other diseases as well. There are some technical challenges specifically with using wastewater for COVID-19. And so we're in touch with the CDC and many others around the world who are trying to evolve those methods. So it's something that we will add to our panoply of indicators and early warning signals.
Dr. Varma. Dr. Varma.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I just want to emphasize that it's not the data that is being presented today by the commissioner and the mayor is information that we have validated. It's not just information that comes in and we try to make a decision based on. It's information that we've looked at carefully to understand how we make critical decisions. I am absolutely a believer in taking every possible data source that we have available to us and using it. But we should only use it to make decisions if we actually have real evidence of its effectiveness. And so if you go back and look at the studies that have been done on wastewater, whether it's for polio eradication or for now for COVID, they have to correlate what happened in the past with what's going to happen in the future. And you have to make decisions based on that and see how they work. And that's really one of the challenges that we have. These are all great studies that have looked back in time, but they haven't actually shown a direction in changing your policy based on that. So it's just a long way of saying that we're absolutely looking at this and working on this, as the commissioner has said. But before we introduce it into real-time decision-making, we have to trust the information is telling us what we know it's telling us.
Go ahead, Jillian. Jillian?
Okay, thanks. I have a lot of questions. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm getting a lot of questions from listeners, friends, even my family, about the glut of apartments that are now on the market. I think they're estimating about 13,000, the highest number in 14 years. And with construction resuming, the glut will inevitably grow. The majority of both the existing and future units are luxury or market rate, but the Emergency Tenant Protection Act doesn't really distinguish when it's invoked between, you know, rent levels. So the median household rent for the million stabilized apartments is about $30,000 a year, and about 60% of Section 8 units are stabilized. Can you give any details if you have a contingency plan in case this happens and the vacancy rate is nullified? And what's going to happen to the 20,000 plus controlled apartments? Because they're seniors living on fixed incomes mostly, and they're controlled by the state auspices.
It's a very important question, Jillian. I think I can say this with assurance, especially given the legislature we now have in Albany. And I worked long and hard with countless others to ensure that we finally had a Democratic state Senate. And we've got two leaders in Andrea Stewart Cousins and Carl Hastie in Albany who are both clearly progressive in fighting for the needs of tenants. So it's literally inconceivable to me that there would be any diminution of rent stabilization or rent control. I think it's a fair question to say, could we be in an unprecedented situation? I think that's a very fair question. I thought what you were going to say is, with all of these vacancies occurring, are rent levels in the market going to start to go down? I do think rent levels are going to start to go down. I think you're seeing evidence of it already. But it's a fair question. Could it be a legal trigger? Even if that is possible, I don't have a doubt in my mind that the legislature will immediately create continuity with our current approach to rent stabilization and rent control. We absolutely need that in New York City. If there was any question about that, I and many others would be in Albany fighting for it immediately. But I'm quite confident they will help us continue to protect tenants.
Next up, we have Deborah Lee from Manhattan.
All right. Thank you very much, Jillian Jonas.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
At WBAI. We're done. No, thank you so much.
As we know, Sankofa is to understand our past, to better understand our present so that we can plan better for the future.
That's what I say, isn't it? Let's start with labor history in two.
I'm Rick Smith.
And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that a strike by the Teamsters Union against UPS ended with a victory for the union. The strike had started 15 days earlier. More than 180,000 UPS workers participated in the action. It was the first nationwide strike by UPS workers. At the time, UPS delivered 80% of all packages in the United States. The company, known for its signature brown trucks, delivered 12 million packages a day. The key issue of the strike was that the company increasingly relied on part-time workers. The insecurities of part-time work were growing, not just at UPS, but for workers in industries all across the country. The strike settlement came with the union winning its core issues. The company agreed to convert 10,000 part-time jobs to full-time positions over the course of the next 5 years. The victory was significant for the U.S. labor movement. The 1980s and 1990s saw new attacks on labor unions and working people, starting with President Ronald Reagan's breaking of the air traffic controller union strike in 1981. The UPS victory in a national strike with broad rank-and-file support encouraged working people beyond the Teamsters Union. Announcing the settlement of the strike, ABC News anchor Peter Jennings declared, quote, "It's been the most dramatic confrontation between industry and organized labor in two decades." Teamsters President Ron Carey said, quote, "It's what this country needs. Decent jobs, a chance for the dream, a chance to purchase a home, a chance to bring your children up properly, a chance to send them to college. Enough is enough, and it's about time that people start fighting back on this."
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's Labor History in 2 Minutes with Rick Smith. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and we're just about ready to go to our sister station, WPFW in Washington, D.C., for our newscast coming up in a couple of minutes. We're going to wind up this day in peace and social justice history, part of that Sankofa moment, looking back in history to see where we've come from, to help us understand how we exist in this current moment and help us chart a course for the future. August 19th, 1791, Benjamin Banneker, the first recognized African-American scientist, a son of former slaves, sent a copy of his just-published almanac to the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, along with an appeal about, quote, the injustice of a state of slavery. And in 1953, on this date, royalist troops surrounded, bombarded, and burned the residence of Mohammad Mossadegh, the recently dismissed elected Iranian prime minister, after having briefly fled his country for Italy due to the rioting over his unconstitutional dismissal of Mossadegh. Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was returned to the Peacock Throne with dictatorial power. All this was done with the planning, financing, and assistance of the CIA and its British counterpart, MI6. In 1958, the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Youth Council in Oklahoma City, led by Clara Looper, a high school history teacher, began sit-ins to desegregate lunch counters inspired by success in Wichita, Kansas. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, wrapping up the Sankofa moment in time, August 19th, 1989. Anglican bishop and Nobel Peace Prize winner Desmond Tutu, was among hundreds of black demonstrators, members of mass democratic movement, who were whipped and blasted with sand stirred up by helicopters as they attempted to picnic on a whites-only beach near Cape Town, South Africa, August 19th, 1989. All right. This has been Living for the City on WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Michael G. Haskins. Thank you so much for tuning in. And hopefully you'll support by calling our pledge line at 516-513-5151.
6602. I really need this song. You'll feel better, I swear. By Evans Thompson. Don't and let it get under your skin. True story. Valid for the working man. The trick is just to be cool. Make you jump right out of your pants. The news is coming. Once you're caught, you'll start to dance. When you see them coming, get out of the way. Or blow the rest of the day. Don't take it home with you. To yourself, you must be true. Leave it behind is what you gotta do. The trick is just to be cool. Ballad for the man who works all day. Comes home, don't know how to play. He's all alone, working hard. He just has to relax.
New moons of the year. He pockets our blood and our sweat, leaves us to our tears. More, more, more lawmakers.
WPSW in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin, and here are some news headlines. Democrats officially nominated Joe Biden as their presidential candidate last night during the second night of their virtual convention. Democratic delegates cast their votes remotely from locations across all 50 states, the American territories, and the District of Columbia. The evening's speakers included former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, who called Trump a president of cowardice. Biden will formally accept the nomination in his convention speech Thursday evening. Tonight, Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris, and former boss President Barack Obama will headline the event. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said on Tuesday that he will suspend some cost-cutting measures and operational changes at the Postal Service until after the November election. It's not clear whether some of the changes, like the removal of sorting machines, can be undone before election time, and at least 20 state attorneys general have filed lawsuits against potential mail delays. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called DeJoy's announcement inadequate and said she would push ahead. She will push ahead with legislation later this week to prevent election year mail changes and provide emergency postal funds. DeJoy is expected to provide more details on his plans in testimony before the Senate on Friday and the House of Representatives on Monday. Meanwhile, Trump continues to falsely claim that universal mail-in voting will lead to widespread fraud and even an election do-over. The campaign to re-elect President Trump on Tuesday filed a lawsuit against the state of New Jersey over the governor's plan for universal mail-in ballots in the upcoming November election. The Trump campaign argued in the suit that universal vote-by-mail opens the election up for voter fraud. The American Civil Liberties Union released a report today on fatal police shootings in the time of COVID-19. The report finds police continue to fatally shoot people in the same rate so far in 2020 as they did in the same period from 2015 to 2019. The report also shows that several states saw a rise in the rate of people fatally shot by police in 2020 over the previous 5 years, and that Black, Native Americans, and Latinx people are still more likely than white people to be killed by the police. Coronavirus has now killed more than 781,000 people worldwide out of over 22.1 million confirmed cases. The United States remains the worst affected country in the world with over 5.4 million diagnosed cases and over 171,000 deaths. The U.S. reported more than 1,300 new deaths yesterday. That's more than triple the number of deaths reported on Monday. The World Health Organization warned Tuesday that young people are becoming the primary drivers of the spread of coronavirus in many countries. Experts feel that the global trend seen by WHO may grow in the United States as many colleges and schools reopen. The University of Notre Dame has halted in-person classes for 2 weeks after the institution confirmed 147 cases of coronavirus infections, barely